So, in speaking about continuing with the topic of Dharma, since when we choose to become Buddhist or work with meditation, one begins to learn, one begins to see the importance of working with one's own self. If Buddhahood is to be obtained, then it is dependent on one's own self. And the path that leads to that is called the Dharma. But the Dharma must be understood accurately. Dharma must have the aspects of cessation of affliction and the generation and completion of wisdom. In order that the afflictions are defeated, the greatest support to bringing about the cessation of affliction and thereby the complete understanding of Dharma, one must develop mindfulness. In order that the mindfulness be such that it is able to seize or bring about the cessation of affliction and the arising and manifestation, full manifestation of wisdom, one must also know the nature of, the true nature of reality of all phenomena, external and internal. To be able to realize the wisdom of knowing things as they truly are, the Buddha taught the fundamental essence of Dharma in the form of the 12 Nidanas or explaining causal dependency. So causal dependency or interdependent origination, dependent arising, all of the different terms, or Pratitya Samutapada as it is referred to in Sanskrit, can be seen in all subtle and broader perspectives. From a general sort of a teaching, of course, one can see the cyclic existence itself, right from how a consciousness propelled by karmic formation, sustained by ignorance. Now, there are two factors. A strong force that propels, and the propelling of it, the force of it, energized, brought about by ignorance. So two characteristics, ignorance and the karmic formation, propels the consciousness to becoming an embryo, that embryo of the sort of the dot or the seed of conception, beginning to become the basis for aggregates to be formed. And full manifestation of the aggregates leading to its projection of sensations, primarily feeling, contact, craving, grasping. This morning, when we talked about personalizing aggregates, the personal experience of the aggregates are what we are talking about in the context of Nidanas, referred to as contact, feeling, grasping, craving, and then grasping, these four factors. And so that makes what is an indefinite seed a very definite formation. And therefore, that is an idea taking shape. The consciousness designs this idea of the ignorance and the karmic formation and creates an impactful, definite, concrete, where form becomes very solid, independent, concrete. Feelings become very concrete. Perceptions become very concrete. Of course, all the formations and the consciousness's activities are seen as the basis, which are very concrete. And so the becoming fully concrete is the birth process, the becoming and the birth process. Even for an embryo, where senses come into being, where contact of the senses become more pronounced, where feelings and then the sort of the cravings and the graspings, because of the pleasure that it experiences and begins to personalize, unpleasant feelings that it begins to see as personal experiences, when that grasping to pleasant, craving to the pleasant, and then anything opposite to that becomes an unpleasant experience. Even in abandoning, there is ownership. There is immediate sense of, I do not want that. So even in abandoning, since there is craving, since there is grasping, craving for the opposite, therefore it rejects, it repels. Therefore, such a sort of a embryo begins to develop into a full-fledged being, birth, then old age, sickness, and death. That is then very much the resultant stages of everything that has been brought into formation. Therefore, when the Buddha says, in reference to the Pratityasamutpada, he says, because there is this that exists, because this came into being, that came into being, because there is ignorance, there is the volitional act that comes into being. So three statements that are seen as the basis through which the 12 nidanas can be understood. So because of this, that comes into being. Because this came into being, that comes into being, is a simple statement that really focuses upon the law of causality. And so that taken into subtler aspect of the 12 nidanas, which would be momentary nidanas. In every minute, you go through the cycle of the 12. In every thought, you go through the 12 cycles. Just as I said, the 12 nidanas can be a full life cycle of an embryo's birth to death to rebirth again. Likewise, the same 12 factors can be taken into any larger or smaller perspective. You can trace it in a span of 24 hours. You can trace it in a span of a minute. You can trace it to a span of your own one single thought. Every situation that evolves and is based upon the causality, law of causality, because of this, that happens. Because this came into being, that came into being, has the same formation. And so understanding the subtle aspect of the nidanas, understanding the grosser form of the nidanas, understanding the nidanas in the context of 1 to 12, which is the origin, understanding nidana from the 12th to the 1, which is then leading it to cessation, becomes necessary sort of analysis, examination for all meditators to carry on. Then continuing from what we have been saying, because of this, that comes into being. With regard to the method of Jigme Lingpa's teaching on the 12 nidanas, very short presentation, he does say, because of not, now I'm going to read it very slowly, a rough translation, so you can write it down and use that for your contemplation. Because of not knowing the true nature. And then if you see what not knowing is, what we call ignorance, for all meditators, always keep in mind, there is no one singular ignorance. Everything of which that you do not know the truth is in ignorance, is already shaded by the ignorance. Therefore, it says, when we say, because of this, that happens. So seeing it in the same logic, with the same kind of logic, therefore we say, because of not knowing the true nature, the other is seen. So that's the birth of duality. So it's not because you're pushed by someone else. There is no one particular cause that is mistaken and therefore begins to be the formulation of ignorance. It just is, bad itch kind of a thing. When you have a bad itch, then you go to scratch it. That's the birth of duality. So every time you have an itch, then immediately, no, that's the same way. Is that because of not knowing, you're diverted towards the others. So because of not knowing the true nature, the other is seen. So one can say the other is seen, although the more Tibetan way of looking at it is, maybe the translation is better if it says, because of not knowing the true nature, the other becomes prominent. Whatever it is, becomes prominent. Now, what becomes more prominent is given form. So this, at this level, the form has to be correctly understood. So therefore, maybe using Lochen Rinpoche's interpretation of form here is better idea. So where the other becomes prominent, whatever becomes more prominent is given a form or an idea which is indefinite and insubstantial. Now, it is called form, but it would be a mistake if it were to be seen as a very definite, formulated form or a concept. At this level, it's an impulse. It's simply an energy. It is simply an impulse. But whatever becomes more prominent is given an insubstantial and an indefinite form. This indefinite form locates or searches for familiarity, looks for familiarity, searches for familiarity. If it finds something familiar, it's found it. If it doesn't find what it is looking for, then there is displeasure. Even in confusion, there is some search. So what it means is, where it locates or searches for familiarity, it is not searching for someone really sort of formulated. Between finding and searching for, what satisfies that moment is the search, not so much what you locate. Therefore, it doesn't matter whether it is pleasurable. It doesn't matter whether it is something unpleasant. Even in confusion, it is quite happy. So we're talking about this, what we usually in text find as neutral emotion or neutral feeling. But neutral feelings are confused feelings. So even in confusion, it's quite happy. What does it mean is, just the fact that it can continue with the impulse of distraction is satisfactory enough here. So here is what probably would be a good proverb to use. Bliss, what is that called? Ignorance is bliss. So the blissful kind of experience, even in confusion. So therefore it says, what becomes more prominent is given an insubstantial or an indefinite form. This then immediately tries to search for or locates familiarity, even in confusion. Now, when it locates whatever, pleasant, unpleasant, neutral, familiar thing, immediately it branches into two kind of an aspects, characteristics. Here it says, some of that action or cause lie dormant, retaining the power of becoming active sometime in the future. And so, immediately when it finds something, it's an action, it's an impulse. But the impulse immediately sort of breaks into two directions. Part of it remains dormant, sort of a passive state, that is called sort of the seed of karma. It retains the imprint, retaining the power that sometime in the future, when positive conditions come together, it has the potential of continuing its activity. Temporarily, it remains dormant. Second aspect of that, what search, the search leads to, is what immediately continues to become actively sort of in action or engaged. This is then, this morning as we talked about, the causal consciousness. So when the mind immediately begins to have a sense of a search, search leads to formulation, that seed immediately, part of the information is retained, lies dormant, part of it becomes active. Whatever becomes active contributes to productions. So immediately, whatever formulations, if the pleasant is formulated, for example, if you have a small sense of pleasant feeling, that pleasant feeling expressed is the causal consciousness's activity. It's immediately becoming engaged, and it has the activeness to producing more causes, more experiences, and then it sort of continues its production. But at the same time, when that pleasant feeling is felt, not only is there an expressivity of that pleasantness, but there is familiarity that is retained at the basic level of the consciousness. So it affirms previous information that you need to relate. So it sort of splits into two. You retain some information, you express some information. So a sense of two activities of the consciousness happens. Therefore, it is called resultant consciousness that retains and becomes a result that you have a reference for in the future. So that the next thought comes, it can have a reference point of what it is going to relate to. So you can say something like, yes, this is just as good as yesterday. So there's a fair amount of references to yesterday and what you have felt. So your mind is always trying to produce a reference that it can relate to. Subtle level of your consciousness retains that memory. And so where you, what we call memory, are all of that familiar experiences that we are keeping as references that allow fundamentally us to believe that the mistaken moving away in solidification or all the later things that we do have some reasonable reasons, that there is a reason why you need to retain that. That's where we say, well, I need to keep in mind what he said to me. Things like that. So that we allow that part of the message to be retained so that 10 years down the line, you can say something, see what I told you. So those are the references that we relate to immediately. But of course, not only that, but the main causal contribution that happens is the active causes that come about. And therefore, here it says, what continues actively, called the causal consciousness, contributes to productions. It contributes to sowing the seeds. It creates tremendous imprints on the stream of consciousness. And in the future, when the resultant consciousness from its dormant state begins to become a reference, it doesn't have to go deep enough into looking at its fuller sort of nature or the reality of things as they are. It simply has a reference that it's okay to be angry. It's okay to be selfish. It's okay to retain your identity. So the consciousness where it plants all the seeds within the stream of consciousness reasserts again and again the similar kind of familiar feelings that supports our engaging more in the dualistic tendencies. And therefore, when that is continued, then definite formulation begins to take place, particularly supported by the resultant consciousness, the store base, the storehouse of information, and the expressivity of active consciousness, which is always functioning, causal consciousness, which is always functioning. That then immediately gives or contributes to definite formulation or definite concept. So this morning when we were talking about the aggregates and how a much more definite gathering of the aggregates begin to become a personal experiences, then here is where from the third nidana, the consciousness, it immediately goes into name and form, where not only the aggregates have been now given some form of familiarity, but the personalization of the aggregates begin to take shape. And so name is given, forms are immediately sort of grasped to because of the familiarity. So within one's own consciousness, when you say something like liking, then immediately to that like, there is a name, you have a concept, you have a reference. It can become your personal liking. And therefore, to that, the feeling becomes a personal experience. The perception of what you like becomes a personal experience. Forms that lead you to this pleasurable experience, such as another person, becomes a personal experience. So name and form is where what has up till now remained very indefinite becomes very definite. It has shape, it has form, it has a fully manifest conceptual aggregate that becomes completely shaped. And therefore, the personal experience dominates the awareness at this point. So what could be left as an indefinite coming together of aggregates begins to have a much more sort of a solidification or solidity. And therefore, in that moment, the things come into being. So in the context of, let's say, life form, then we talk about an embryo, which then has all the sense faculties, all of the different kinds of senses, sense objects that come into being, and then feelings, perceptions, and the further the aggregates formation begins to take place. In the case of subtle approach to the 12 Nidanas, here, if you look into one's own mind, there is a full, fresh thought that has immediately been given some kind of a conceptual name. This is a good thought, or this is a bad thought. So when you immediately begin to see it, then you associate, because of your senses, you immediately associate the good thought to be because of the beauty of the flowers. So you posit now the other, it becomes more definite. Up till now, the flower was there, but it wasn't a very definite, because the grasping was not so much there. But now suddenly it becomes very, very definite, and you immediately begin to become more clearly aware. Oh, there is pink, there is red, there is white. And so this is the way how simple, indefinite formations of the mind, when given more, when the grasping, when the craving, when the senses, when the contact of the senses take place, when all of these formulations take place, then immediately there is more structure, definiteness given to it, shape given to it, form given to it, ownership given to it. Then it becomes the flower on the table. Flower on the table placed by, I don't know who, Linda, Jesse. Oh, Jesse, yes, our Chöpen, head of rituals. Then immediately, something that was very indefinite. Jesse's been in the room all the while. But at the same time, now the concentration is Jesse. Who's Jesse? Mark's wife, Jesse. Now we shift to Mark. Isn't it? So the moment everything arises, it's not that things are not there. Causes are always there. Aggregates are always there. But what is indefinite, what is in the field of our awareness, when the personalization of it comes about, when you focus upon it, then the solidification begins to take place. So therefore, most of the teachers who teach meditation, one of the very famous lines of our Buddhist tradition is the dialogue between Naropa and Telopa, when he says, it is not the outer phenomena, inner phenomena, that creates causes of suffering. It is the grasping tendency that creates the suffering. It is the grasping and the constant personal experience that you assert over the aggregates. That is what then creates the confusion. Things by themselves do not create the distraction. Your grasping creates the distraction. Therefore, taming the mind with mindfulness allows it to bring about the cessation of the grasping. And so where the grasping ceases, then it allows things to remain what they are, whatever they may be. Aggregates, by virtue of their own activeness, will arise, will manifest, will cease. Primarily, our thoughts will arise, will manifest, will cease. But if one doesn't interfere with them, if one doesn't constantly sort of bring about a strong emphasis of the personal experience of that particular feeling, of that particular emotion, then nothing will increase. Nothing will create the distraction. Nothing by themselves have the power of bringing about delusion or distraction and disturbances. However, having said that, now if we look at the reversal process, most of us, what we tend to do is then try to bring about non-grasping, since as we have just spoken about, grasping is the cause of confusion. So we try not to grasp at things. But then the not grasping doesn't become very successful, simply because not grasping, if it arises with a firm belief of the reality of the other, then you're getting into a very unsuccessful attempt to trying to defeat every other thing. That is where meditators run into seclusion, isolate themselves. They think silence and concentration is dependent upon living in an isolated place, far away from all noise and chaos. Sometimes it helps. for the first 1 or 2 weeks. But ultimately, what happens is this is a forced way of subduing things which has not much the power of actually recognizing where the grasping is coming from. If the grasping was coming from the other, then yes, you could run away from it. But where the grasping is coming from within, then no matter where you go, isolated or not, it's going to be the same person. Therefore, we say a person can be more busy in an empty cave than in a castle of many rooms. Because the mind of the person still sustains the firm belief of things to be separate from one's own self. The duality, the other, is still more strong in one's own mind. Therefore, in order to bring about grasping, the cessation of grasping, it has to cease the craving. But the craving cannot really cease until the feeling doesn't cease. If there is feeling, there's always going to be craving. Now, forcefully seizing or sort of subjugating the feeling, that also doesn't help. Because it's not the feeling alone. You'd have to deprive the feeling of contact in order for the feeling to not happen. So that means you'd have to keep your senses, sense consciousness, and the sense objects really separate. Send your sense to Tibet. Send your sense consciousness to Hawaii. Sense object, keep it in the United States. Now, you can't do that either. It's an illogical thing to do. So wherever there are the three, sense, sense consciousness, sense objects, wherever the three of them are there, contact is always going to be there. Now, contact, to now say, well, then it seems that contact is to be blamed. If contact is to be blamed, then that would mean you'd have to defeat contact. To defeat contact, you'd have to then defeat senses. So you have to tell, now it's too late already, but next life, you have to tell your mother, future mother, I don't want senses. Now that's also not possible. We already have the senses. So then what do? In order to bring about cessation of suffering, do we stop senses? Yes, senses is also not at fault here. Senses is not at fault because the blame is not the senses. The blame has to be put on name and form. It's only because of this that that came into being. So senses came into being, and their activeness came into being, and their feeling and grasping came into being because of the name and form. Now, the question would be is, why do we name things? That's a good question, which the Buddha always said. Why do you label things? Why do you name things? Why do you index things? Why does everything have to be captured with a certain name, with a certain concept? Why can't forms just be forms? Why does it have to be always given a certain name? Why can't feelings be just feelings? Why must it always be embroiled in all the complexities of how you emotionally feel about feelings? Why can't perceptions just be perceptions? Why must it be a personal experience of perception? Why can't formations be given the freedom to simply be formations? Why must there be an interference constantly brought about in how formations have to take place? When somebody is cooking in the kitchen and you go inside the kitchen and say, what are you cooking? It hardly requires you to, the cook will tell you. It hardly requires you to ask what's cooking. It'll be served. I heard that many times from the cooks and those who went to look at it. Both sides. Isn't it? So interference is interference, just as we interfere with simple things. When you call somebody on the cell phone these days, First thing anyone asks is, where are you? We never found it so necessary to find a location. It's almost like, I'm not going to talk to you until I have a picture in mind of where you are. But we are pointing to the interference, the asserting of the interference that we bring in. Name and form becomes very crucial. It's the constant shift from what could be pervasive awareness to transforming it into a personal experience. So what is awareness? What is personal experience? What is the difference between the two? Awareness is much more deeper or a humble understanding as well as giving freedom for the aggregates to be what it is. It's a very matter-of-fact relationship. Personal experiences, looking at it through your own eyes. There's a lot of gain and loss, hope and fear, agendas involved in this interpretation of the aggregates. So things are not what it is. Things are what you want it to be. What it is not what you want it to be. And a rather sort of a deeper sense of reluctance to even go into a much more clearer understanding of what it is to be. So it sustains the ignorance. So name and form, as much as is a basis from where external causes are created, more causes are created, the basis from where a lot of the rampantness of the production of the causes are created, it also is the place, almost like a speed bump, for you to stop at that point and not challenge further, but accept things as they have always been. So we accept certain things are beautiful. You know, there's a kind of a general consensus that we're all going to agree that certain things are beautiful, certain things are ugly, certain things are good, certain things are bad. We have very specific ideas. We wake up at a certain point. We go to bed at a certain point. Anyone who does anything beyond that is a crazy person. Very definite ideas. When you walk into a shrine room, there are specific points to bow, specific places to stand, specific ways to sort of see, look, think. So nobody challenges that. Like dutiful sheep, we all go in a flock, memorizing a lot of names, memorizing a lot of concepts. This is right, this is wrong. Doesn't bother who says, who agrees it is right, who agrees it is wrong. So everything is boxed. Everything is framed. Everything is solidly structured. And until everybody believes and behaves in that solid structure, nobody is going to be called normal. Anyone who does anything out of the box, we send them to the mental hospitals. It's not normal people. What is not normal? Because they hallucinate, we tell them. They see things that are not there. We always joke about it. Buddhists have this joke. We lock all those people who think there are things that are not actually there. Yeah. We lock them up. Then here we are, the sensible ones, who've memorized lots of dictionaries. So good to call this right, that wrong, this way to do things, this way not to do things. Even a small thing as, let's say, someone not forgetting to place, you know, this flower has been on this table, on that spot for the last 8 years. Now, one day goes a teaching where somebody doesn't, oh, that's the break of protocol. This is not the traditional way of doing things, we say things. So where did it begin? There's lots of flowers outside. It's very fine. But no, we have to do things. And there's a manual that says, flower on the left side, water on the right side. So when there is this sort of very concreteness through which we begin to live, such a person oftentimes takes name for granted, takes forms for granted, takes everything that we have created a conceptual belief of to be true, unchallenged, and we become very submissive to it. We become slaves to it. And the retaining of that allows us sort of at the consciousness level. Even after death, you come back to the same sort of retaining of the same imprint. The same imprint sort of becomes strong and it influences children. So look at the birth of a new child. People poke their faces into a child's face saying, Papa, Mama, concept, name, first words in the dictionary. Isn't it? And so now the child has previous karmic impulses to refer to. Oh yeah, don't like Papa? Cry. Like Mama? Smile. So it's an impulse, but you have to, in your mind, think about the impulse that it does refer to. It's a very indefinite impulse, but it does allow you to make sense of what others are projecting to you at the moment. So there is outer causes, your own inner causes, combined with the conditioned world and the different concepts of what we believe. They fuel and support all the solidifications through which we are conditioned to performing mechanically as slaves to conceptual beliefs. And so, geographical locations, this immense humorous way of looking at the visa situations in the world today. Now, those of you who don't travel don't have to go through that. But look at our poor Canadians who are trying to come for programs in the United States. I don't know if it's the same the other way too, is it? Canadians say it's not, but I don't know. There is such a thing as reciprocity, isn't it? So it must be the same. But Canadians, yes, recently I've been hearing that a lot. For a Tibetan, it makes no sense. Canada, USA, we see them as, you know, we don't even know where the lines are. But there is a bridge somewhere, and there's a little booth somewhere in which there sits a person who separates you. And then those Canadians trying to cross the border. You know. I don't think they shiver so much, but there's the apprehension. What's your name? And they forget. So these are based upon some of the jokes that we share with people who've had been recently having such kind of experiences. But that is, you know, that's how human beings are. All the distinctions that we have made, black and white, good and bad, religious distinctions. When we ask someone such as, are you Buddhist? How long have you been a Buddhist? Have you taken refuge? Do you want to take refuge? These are the questions going on today. So here it is. It's immediately where forms are being given, concepts are being given, mind is being coached to go up till name and form and nothing beyond that. Make the references, take fresh ones to support older references, re-strengthen the older references to produce more without questioning, without challenging. And therefore, when up till the consciousness level, we retain that kind of an approach. It never questions what is the true nature of reality. What is the true nature of thoughts? What is the true nature of appearance? What is the true nature of everything that we suppose to be as it is? Now, only if that much of a supposition was all that was happening, then still it would not be so problematic. But not only do we not question, but because of these concepts, very strict, definite concepts that we have created, we begin to encourage ourselves into the most dominant karmic formation, and that is liking some things, disliking other things, and the indifference to most. So therefore, consciousness name and form does get a lot of support and gives a lot of support to the second Nidana, karmic formation, where it constantly breathes this impulse. It's a kind of a wavelength of energy which re-strengthens and sort of always affirms the three major sort of emotions or three major preferences, impulses of liking, of disliking, of indifference. So up till making a concept, creating a concept, that is not a problem. But where what you have created becomes a personal experience that begins to again bring about a sort of added influence of liking certain things, disliking certain things, and becoming indifferent to certain things, then the causes that are created combined together with what you like makes you very stubborn, makes you very rigid. And so yesterday when we talked about uncompromising attitude, what is ego? Ego is an uncompromising attitude. So there is, again, just as there is no one ignorance, there is no one ego. It is that with everything that is being created, you also bring about a certain degree of uncompromising attitude. So to the impulses of emotionally, the likes that you have an uncompromising attitude. To all the unpleasant feelings that arises, you again relate with an uncompromising attitude. I do not want it, and you're firm with that. I like it, that's how it should be. You're very firm, determined about that. If there is a certain amount of indifference, you're very sure about it. You're very firm about that. It's a very uncompromising. So where there is uncompromising, then 7 billion uncompromising people functioning together. Somebody has to win, somebody has to lose. One whose uncompromising attitude wins is a happy person for the moment. One who loses that uncompromising moment is a sad person of the moment. So sadness leads to better challenging the next time. Happiness leads to reenacting of the same the next time. And so there's no end. So unwantingly, whatever we create as causes that lead to the field of experiences come about because of the prominence of the karmic formation, which is nothing but this emotionally liking things, not liking things, the indifferent attitude, which finds its ground and validity upon the assertion of name and form. And therefore, 12 Nidanas, if we look at it, have this way of manifesting creation all the time. But at the same time, one of its very unique features is how each of them support the other. So it would not be so difficult if they all came out in a sequence of one after the other. It does come in the sequence, but at the same time, grasping can strike immediately the karmic formation. Karmic formation can immediately assert the feeling, support the feeling. The feeling can immediately go to the consciousness and have the references looked into so that the becoming becomes even more facilitating. So all the dynamics of the different links of interdependency as it functions move in both the directions. It expresses and it supports the expression so that the coming back of that information is just as sort of more believable or something that you can trust very much. So all the causes that you are creating is the expressivity. All the experiences that you are feeling is the feedback that you are getting. And that feedback makes the future expressivity of the causes even more sort of believable, more logical, more necessary, makes more sense. Therefore, in the teachings when we say samsara begins to make sense, we don't like it, we see the suffering, we see the transformation, we see what samsara is for what it is, but still we find a lot of sense in samsara is because the feedback that we are getting, that the mind is getting, is that it's all right to still continually find the ownership, find the personalization, to assert the self. And so the output and the input, both of them go into supporting one another. Therefore, in that regard, within the teachings of the Pratityasamutpada, it says, causes are the consequences, effects. Effects then further become causes. So whatever causes are created, that then again is brought back as more memories or information. It asserts the belief of the duality, and continuity of that begins to churn. And so there is no longer a cessation that comes until this sort of a production of the 12 nidanas is not completely exhausted or reversed. And so cessation, therefore, must come back through the reversal process. And therefore, as we were saying, grasping to craving, then craving, where does that come from? Comes from feelings. Feeling, where does that come from? Contact. Contact comes from the senses. Senses come from name and form. Name and form comes from consciousness. What is the nature of consciousness? Nothing. Isn't there anything? There's only impulse, an impactful impulse of preferences. Some vague idea. That idea that it has to like, that idea that it has to dislike, that idea that there can be the validity of indifference. But where is it? Therefore, the breakthrough or the disintegration of the ignorance can only come about when you can say, posit what you like, posit what you don't like, posit the validity of indifference. So if you're going to state you like, you have to show me what you like. If you're going to state you dislike, you have to prove what is it that you dislike. And so meditators, therefore, in the Mahayana tradition, in the Hinayana tradition, and then leading on to the Prajnaparamita teachings, the whole concept of emptiness, nature of things come into being is the simple question, where are you asserting your preferences? How can you state you like or you dislike without there being a fundamental basis that you can show as the point upon which you can then assert your preferences of liking and disliking? So then when that question is put to us, we immediately say, yes, but I like something. And so, what thing? And then when we ask, what is it that I like? We immediately say, oh, phenomena. Basically, what can we come up with? Quickly, if we say, what do you like? Well, chocolates are on sale, so chocolate. Expensive chocolate. Deliciously expensive chocolate. So when we say, oh, this is what I like, then Madhyamika says, okay, so what is it that you like in the chocolate? And then we go into the disintegration of the form. And we begin to say, where would you posit your like? On the almonds, on the cream, on the different kinds of the ingredients, on the taste? Then you would have to also say chocolate on your tongue. You have to give credit to your tongue too. And so the Mahayana leads into a sense of understanding how things come into being where many parts create a whole. So it re-educates the mind to actually seeing aggregates as it is beyond the personal experience of it. And so in that regard, now, here is where we then connect into the meditation itself. So how do we then cultivate a contemplation so acutely concentrated upon the breakthrough of the aggregates so that the aggregates remain what they are and untainted by the grasping, untainted by one's own sort of assertion of personal experience. So one here begins to say, it is not the fault of the phenomena, the aggregates. If the fault comes because of the preferences unnecessarily put in, and the basis of the preferences simply being is that there is more domination of the self and the self's experiences rather than what the things truly are. Can you appreciate chocolate in the same way as you appreciate 100 other things? Or vice versa, can you appreciate everything as you would appreciate a chocolate? Why does one thing have to be more than the other? Then you see, it's the personal experience of it. The pleasurable personal experience that is more in certain things. Then a cause has been created not because of the thing, but because of your own personal preferences of it. And so where such a cause has been brought into production, then of course it catches up and it creates more and more sort of different kinds of opinions and judgments. And that is how we then have to validate anger, we have to validate aggression, desires, selfishness, and everything. Everything comes into production because of not being able to break through that. So to reverse that project would be is to dissolve the liking, to dissolve the dislike, to dissolve the indifference, such that a much more uniform, equal way of non-discriminating way of looking at things would be able to be realized. But in order to bring about a sense of what in the Vajrayana teachings is called a one-taste relationship, seeing all forms in the same way, seeing all tastes in the same way, so that there can be a much more deeper appreciation of everything as it is, not only based upon one's own personal experience, outweighing what it is in its natural essence, requires one to then tame the mind, train the mind into breaking free from the sort of immense power of discrimination, of likes and dislikes. So in order to bring about such a concentration that the production of the causes of likes and dislikes, the karma itself, doesn't happen, then the method given in the sutra teachings, which then are much more practiced within the Hinayana traditions, especially within the Pali tradition, is known as the Four Foundations of Mindfulness. Now, if you look at the text itself, I will read through the section of the text and then go through the connection of what we have been talking about. Here it says, "Thus have I heard. At one time, the Blessed One, the Buddha, was living among the Kurus at Kamasadama, a market town of the Kuru people. There the Blessed One addressed the bhikshus thus, 'Monks,' and they replied to him, 'Venerable Sir,' the Blessed One spoke as follows, 'This is the only way, monks, for the purification of beings, for the overcoming of sorrow and lamentation, for the destruction of suffering and grief, for reaching the right path, for the attainment of Nibbana, namely the four foundations of mindfulness.' What are the four?" Now in this one paragraph, here is what we have been trying to say. Where in order to be able to overcome sorrow, destruction, lamentation, suffering, grief, in order to reach nirvana, in Pali, Nibbana. And so, in order to bring about cessation of suffering, realizing one's own responsibility, as we talked about yesterday, the responsibility arising because what is being created and causes, you are responsible. Therefore, the cessation is also responsible for one's own self. In order that the cessation be brought about, you have to cut the pathway for the causes to be propelled. And that cutting of the path comes about by taming the mind. Taming the mind is so that the ignorance is not strong, but the strength of the ignorance is sustained if the likes, dislikes propels into an idea, that which is then a personal experience, and then the continuity of all the nidanas begin to happen. Therefore, to reverse the nidanas, the Buddha then referred to the group of monks to whom the teachings were given, the practice of what is called the four foundations of mindfulness. So what are these four? Are the mindfulness of body, mindfulness of feeling, mindfulness of mind, and mindfulness of phenomena. Herein a monk lives, contemplating the body in the body, ardent, clearly comprehending and mindful, having overcome in this world covetousness and grief. He lives contemplating feelings and feeling, ardent, clearly comprehending and mindful, having overcome in this world covetousness and grief. He lives contemplating consciousness and consciousness, ardent, clearly comprehending and mindful, having overcome in this world covetousness and grief. He lives contemplating mental object in mental objects, ardent, clearly comprehending and mindful, having overcome in this world covetousness and grief. Now, having overcome in this world is renunciation. Covetousness and grief are the adornment of renunciation. No one can actually really develop a strengthened attitude of wanting to bring about cessation without renunciation. The first day we talked about it. Yesterday morning also we talked about it. Sense of renunciation is looking at affliction and the damaging tendencies of affliction. What can anger cause? The destructive nature of anger, destructive nature of selfishness, destructive nature of ignorance, having a clear understanding of afflictions as poison, and therefore wanting to truly free oneself from such affliction. When a true renunciation arises in the mind, such a person then will be able to have the strengthened wish to bringing about cessation of the 12 interdependent origination. So the production to bring about the cessation of that production will be strong in such a mind. Now, half-heartedly, I don't want some anger. I don't want some selfishness. It would be nice if cessation happened, but I don't know whether I can do it. I'm not sure that it is really altogether necessary. If that half-hearted approach is there, and if we look in our own selves, we all have that half-hearted approach, then renunciation is very weak. So where renunciation is very weak, then you'll have to ask yourself the question, do you really want cessation? Are you quite satisfied, especially with the entertainment of the consciousness? It's lovely to be able to name names. It's quite fun playing with feelings. Like a sort of a, therefore, you know, one of the sort of symbols for the consciousness is a monkey. Why is it a monkey? In the iconographies, if you look, consciousness is always depicted as a monkey that is never able to be in one place. It always jumps from one direction to the other direction. Why is that so? It's because the mind actually likes to be naughty. It likes the whole idea that you can do strange things as name things, trap feelings, solidify them, play with them, make others unhappy, make yourself happy, make others happy. So there's a lot of flavor to it, a lot of entertainment to it. Now, as long as the entertainment still is enticing to the mind, there will always be difficulties with meditation and cultivating mindfulness. Because mindfulness will always have to keep on stressing itself. There is an added pressure where meditation will still have to make sense to you. Why am I meditating? And so therefore, one of the key factors to this is when you always think a teacher or a sangha is important to you for inspiration. You know, sort of, I always say, if the inspiration is like a balloon, then through the year it becomes deflated. Closer to the annual retreat, it's sort of all shriveled up. So you come to the annual retreat, we pump it up again. It becomes big, really inspired. Then, you sustain it with the Lopan's visit through the winter. It becomes a little bit there and there, but you're never really sure. Spring is always the critical period. It's almost dying out. The summer is this season for inspiration. So when that kind of thing happens, the main reason is not because of any other thing, but still the distractions of the pleasures of there being the freedom to formulate things, the conceptualization of things, is a remarkably entertainment. It's a remarkable entertainment that is very, very enticing. As long as that still has the glamour, as long as that still is seemingly more important than the cessation of the affliction, there's always going to be a lot of gaps where discouragement and distraction to the path of meditation can happen. So, here, what is the most important thing? It's renunciation. In order to be able to increase renunciation in mind, understanding and clearly looking at the power of affliction is necessary. The damaging power of anger, damaging power of ignorance, damaging power of desire, of arrogance, of jealousy. And therefore, there is no better way than to reflect upon suffering of sentient beings. So the noble truth of suffering becomes emphasized because that is the resultant state of the causes brought about by the causes, ignorance, of course, but the ignorance manifests in the form of attachment, selfishness, anger, and so forth. Here, therefore, the Buddha stresses mindfulness that has overcome this world, and therefore it not is only an overcoming of this world, the container, but the world of afflictions, the causes of tremendous suffering, covetousness and grief, and therefore is able to, from that sense of essence of renunciation, able to still the mind by reflecting upon, by mindfully placing the mind upon the nature of the aggregates without it succumbing to the habitual tendencies of personalizing the experience which brings about grasping. The contemplation of the body is then seen in this way, and as the sutra itself says, how does a monk live contemplating the body in the body? So if someone says, what is the practice of mindfulness? Then the practice of mindfulness is condensed simply in this verse that we have just read. Herein a monk lives contemplating body in the body. Herein the monk lives contemplating feelings in feeling. He lives contemplating consciousness in consciousness, or mind in mind, lives comprehending mental objects in mental objects, clearly comprehending mindfully. So simply being able to remain mindfully in things as they truly are is the fullness of the four foundations of mindfulness. However, when the bhikshus heard this, then they did ask the Buddha, how does one live contemplating body in body? And in expansion to that, in commenting upon how does one contemplate body in the body, then the Buddha answered in this way. Herein, monks, a monk having gone to the forest, to the foot of a tree, or to an empty place, sits down with his legs crossed, keeping his body erect and his mindfulness alert. Even mindfully he breathes in, and mindful he breathes out. Breathing in a long breath, he knows, I am breathing in a long breath. Breathing out a long breath, he knows, I am breathing out a long breath. Breathing in a short breath, he knows, I am breathing in a short breath. Breathing out a short breath, he knows, I am breathing out a short breath. Experiencing the whole breath and the body, I shall breathe in, thus he trains himself. Experiencing the whole body and the breath, I shall breathe out, thus he trains himself. Calming the activity of the breath, calming the activity of the body, I shall breathe in, he trains himself. Calming the activity of the breath, calming the activity of the body, I shall breathe out, thus he trains himself. Thus he lives contemplating the body in the body internally, or he lives contemplating the body in the body externally. Or he lives contemplating the body in the body internally and externally. He lives contemplating origination factors in the body, or he lives contemplating dissolution factors in the body. Or he lives contemplating origination and dissolution factors in the body. or his mindfulness is established with the thought, the body exists, to the extent necessary just for knowledge and mindfulness, and he lives detached and clings to nothing in the world, thus also a monk lives contemplating the body in the body. So the repetition of what the Buddha is the immense kindness and the patience of the Tathagata, of the Buddha, where he encourages simply resting without the dramatics of the ego resurfacing to expound on what the body is. So here we are talking about stilling the mind, allowing the mind so far as to retain its state of awareness, without taking the awareness into an interpretation of your own personal experiences. It is breathing out, it is breathing out. You are breathing in, you are breathing in. Body is sitting, body is sitting. Body is fidgeting, body is fidgeting. Body is the origination of many things, body is the origination of many things. Body is not the origination of many things, body is not the origination of many things. When you keep the story short, mind stills. What distracts the mind from its stillness is the cleverness. When it sits, you want it to stand. When it stands, you want it to sit. When it doesn't do something, you want it to do something. When it does something, you don't want it to do something. And so then the commentary, I always call it the sort of creativity of the sort of a story writer of a soap opera. To keep finding different plots that it can continue, that it can continually manifest. So not doing that. But as the Buddha says, and further, a monk knows when he is going, I am going. He keeps it very short. He knows when he is standing, I am standing. Why am I standing? Are others standing with me? Is my standing better than the other people's standing? This standing is a profound way of standing. I stand as Buddha Vajradhara. I stand so that I can sit later. You know, all of those different interpretations, not going into that. Stilling the mind, what it is, it is. Knowing things as they truly are comes from knowing the things as they truly are, not the commentary of it. It is so, it is not so, it is like that, it is not like that. How is it? And then when you have the discussions, I've been repeatedly telling you, never say two things. How do you feel about this? Or the very important thing that you place into connection. Do you feel connected to the 12 Nidanas? You spend much too much time trying to find your connection to this. That's why you say things like, or things like, I don't feel connected to mudra practice. I don't feel connected to Vajrayana Buddhism. I don't feel connected to Padmasambhava. These are the major non-connections that we struggle with, besides a whole lot of other things. So ultimately, whether you feel connected, whether you don't feel connected, you know, poor teachers, I think, Tibetan teachers especially. Now, Western teachers come from the background of feeling connectedness and not connected, so they can elaborate on that. But when you put that to a Tibetan mind, we are flabbergasted. We have no idea what you're saying. We've learned, however, to give polite answers. If you don't feel connected to Padmasambhava, doesn't matter. Try Shakyamuni. If you don't feel connected there, maybe go to Manjushri. You know, we switch references. And so those are polite answers. If you don't feel connected to Ngondro, sit Shamatha. So off you go, feeling your connection to Shamatha. But beyond the politeness, sometimes I think that polite answer does much damage. Because ultimately, whether you feel connected to or not connected to is not the point here. Much better if you say things like, I don't feel connected to anger. Then, don't feel connected to Ngondro either. I don't feel connected to selfishness. I am having trouble feeling any connection to jealousy. No, you never say that. Hard as they are, unwanted as they are, they are never questioned. It's just a deception of the ego that is prolonging a process by not being definite, by being straightforward, very direct with what one must do. So when this mind is pampered with the tendencies of conveniences arises, and you pamper the same habitual patterns, then likes and dislikes dominate what is reality. Likes and dislikes are likes and dislikes. Whether it is on the object of spiritual practice or whether it is an object of samsara, it still has the propelling impulse and the strength to make it conceptual. Therefore, you do leave one practice to go into doing another practice with just as much attachment. It gets you to doing the numbers and sitting the hours, but it doesn't defeat the production of causes of attachment and aversion. Therefore, it becomes essential. Here, as the Buddha says, he knows when he is standing, I am standing. He knows when he is sitting, I am sitting. He knows when he is lying down, I am lying down. Or just as his body is disposed, so he knows it. It is disposed. Thus he lives contemplating the body in the body. Simply single-pointed concentration on the body as it sits, stands, wherever it is, allowing the mind to be truly focused on the body itself and nothing more, nothing beyond. And further, monks, a monk in going forward and back applies clear comprehension in looking straight on and looking away. He applies clear comprehension. So when you are moving forward, he knows I am moving forward. When you are moving backwards, mindfully, you realize yourself moving backwards. In the same way, he applies clear comprehension in bending and in stretching. He applies clear comprehension in wearing robes and carrying the bowl. He applies clear comprehension in eating, drinking, chewing, savoring. He applies clear comprehension in attending to the calls of nature. He applies clear comprehension in walking, in standing, in sitting, in falling asleep, in waking, in speaking, and in keeping silence. He applies clear comprehension. Oh, I'm falling asleep. Oh, I am awake. And that's it. Short, very direct, clear mindfulness, watching your body. It is walking. That's it. I'm walking, I'm walking, I'm walking, I'm walking, I'm walking. That's also not necessary. A much more pervasive. I'm walking. Here I am. Oh, I was distracted. It is here now. Sense of clearly being mindful, a pervasive mindful that has a much more pervasive view of the action of the body. Thus he lives contemplating the body in the body. And further, monks, a monk reflects on this very body enveloped by the skin and full of manifold impurity from the sole up and from the top of the hair down, thinking thus. So the mindfulness of the body can be broken into certain sections. In the very beginning section is simply, as we just spoke about, mindfully being able to observe the body in whatever situation, in whatever state it may be. Then in sitting meditation, as one is able to have a certain amount of single-pointed concentration of the body, then look a little bit deeper. Look a little bit deeper by reading the section here, and therefore the text has been given to you, is you incorporate that in your meditation, that you read it. And here, reading the second section, reflect, as it says in the sutra, that one's own body is enveloped by the skin. Within it is the manifold impurity from the sole up and from the top of the hair down, thinking. There are in this body hair of the head, hair of the body, nails, teeth, skin, flesh, sinews, bone, marrow, kidney, heart, liver, midriff, spleen, lungs, intestine, mesentery, gorges, feces, bile, phlegm, pus, blood, sweat, fat, tears, grease, saliva, nasal mucus, synovial fluid, urine. If you can add more, keep adding. Basis of this arrogance of the body is this. Arrogant on bones, arrogance of marrow, arrogance of kidney, arrogance of heart, arrogance of liver, arrogance of midriff, arrogance of spleen, arrogance of blood, pus, blood, bile, phlegm, and so on and so forth. What we call the body is a compositeness of this. One must have a clear comprehension of the basis upon which you are going to posit your likes and dislikes. After all, you've done that your whole life, that your body is more important than the bodies of the others. So understand your body. If you're going to assert your arrogance of the body forever in your life, better also know the true nature of what it is that you are asserting upon. So this is what the body is. Clearly, not only counting the names, but as you read through it, slowly, when you say marrow, be aware of the marrows of your body, kidney and spleen and liver and so forth. Clearly locate them in your body. Take the concentration there. Blood, pus, mucus, phlegm, urine, feces, fluid, all of these that one is talking about, feel them. Be able to identify them in one's own body. As the sutra says, just as if there were a double-mouthed provision bag full of various kinds of grains, such as hill paddy, paddy, green gram, cow peas, sesamum, and husk rice, and a man with sound eyes, having opened that bag, were to take stock of the contents thus. This is hill paddy, this is paddy, this is green gram, this is cow pea, this is sesamum, this is husk rice. Just so, monks, a monk reflects on this body, enveloped by the skin, and full of manifold impurity, from the soles up and from the top of the hair down to the finger of one's own toe or the nails of one's own toe. Clearly seeing what is it that this body is made up of. If you yourself do not know the basis of what we call our body, the makeup of our own body, then it will be very, very confused if one is going to simply assert preferences based upon a basis of which you do not have an understanding, clear comprehension of. Therefore, comprehend what the body is made up of. Then furthermore, as one has gained some experience of reflecting upon the makeup of the body, the second aspect of the mindfulness of the body, progress into the third. Thus he lives contemplating the body in the body. And so wherever this line, thus he lives contemplating the body in the body, is referred, one simply strengthens that through repetition. One may take that segment alone in a session of meditation and reflect only on so much. That is also sufficient. Then if one is more familiar with it, then one may progress into incorporating the third stage. And further, monks, did you raise your hands up, Jonathan? No, okay. Monks, a monk reflects on this very body, however it be placed or disposed by way of material elements. There are in this body the element of earth, the element of water, the element of fire, the element of wind. And so, spend time reflecting upon all the elemental qualities of the body. Which part of your body? What ingredients of your body? What parts of your body are composed of the element of earth? What part of your body is the element of water? What part of your body, in essence, in its true nature, is the element of fire? And what part of it is the element of wind? Just as if monks, a clever cow butcher or his apprentices, having slaughtered a cow and divided it into portions, should be sitting at the junction of a four high roads, in the same way a monk reflects on this very body, as it is placed or disposed by way of material elements. There are in this body the element of earth, water, fire, and wind. Thus he lives contemplating the body in the body. So when a butcher in the olden times, even today, sells meat, he cuts up the flesh of the animal and divides them into parts, puts it on a table, sausages, meat, you know, whatever different kinds of meat there are, from different parts of the body. And then he says, this is more expensive, this is from the better part of the body, this is more cheaper, this is the tail, this is the hoof, this is what is the intestine or the sausages, and so on and so forth. And he lays them all out, which was once all brought together with the formation of the skin. In the same way, as you sit, regarding the elements of your body, you place your body in front of you, divided into the elements, the skin, the bone, the flesh, the earth element, mucus, the phlegm, the blood, the pus, the urine, all of the liquid, the water element, the warmth, the sense of sort of warmness and heat in the body, the fire element, the crevices, the different kinds of gaps in the body, being the space or the wind element. And so these are the formations of the body. This is my body. A realistic, truthful, honest approach. Body in action. Body, its compositeness. Body in its elements. Body's real nature as when it is divided into its own element qualities. A clear apprehension, clear understanding, and recognition of the nature of the body is the main emphasis here. And so here says, and further, then, ultimately, the very sort of the poignant part of the practice here. Monks, as if a monk sees a body dead, 1, 2, or 3 days old, swollen, blue and festering, thrown in the charnel ground. He then applies this perception to his own body thus. Verily, also my body is the same nature. Such it will become and will not escape it. Here in the West, you have this wonderful thing called cemeteries. So those, peaceful, nicely, what do you call them? Mowed lawns. And nice places. It's good to look at that. It's the future. Then, one of the unique things that happen. So ultimately, if you are a good Buddhist and your parents and family members support you, most of you end up in an urn. Every year I get several of them. That's how we live our life. Each year I get more than a dozen good friends come back to me in the form of urns. And some people bring them back in Ziploc bags. That's a whole life led in diverse ways, in good ways, and as well as in many cases where there has been assertion. Throughout the living moments, we think, oh, all this makes sense. I need that. I don't need that. I will do this. I will not do this. One of the very good exercises is to sometimes go and open your closet and look into it and see the number of things that you have gotten for yourself. Walk into your homes and think the number of things you've gotten yourself just to believe that one day that urn and the Ziploc will not happen to you. So all of those outer things that we assert is basically to try and continually let at the level of our consciousness to believe that things are permanent, things are solid. And that belief itself is the ground from where all neuroses are given the freedom of production. But here, as it says, verily also my body is of the same nature, such it will become and will not escape it. And further, monks, as if a monk sees a body thrown in the charnel ground, being eaten by crows, hawks, vultures, dogs, jackals, or by different kinds of worms. Yeah, when you beautifully wrap and put him under the ground, no matter what wonderful quotes you write on the tombstone, beneath it, it says, being eaten by the worms. Sounds gory, sounds very sort of unpolite for many of you, especially if you're new Buddhist, not used to this kind of contemplation. It will sound gory, but that's how it is. Why make what is most true and inevitable in our life be negated? That's living in denial. Living in denial is a psychological problem, isn't it? All our psychologists and doctors will tell you that. So, different kinds of worms. He then applies this perception to his own body, thus, verily, also my own body is the same nature, and such it will become and will not escape it. And further, monks, as if a monk sees a body thrown in the charnel ground and reduced to a skeleton with some flesh and blood attached to it, held together by the tendons, reduced to a skeleton, blood besmeared, and without flesh held together by the tendons, or reduced to a skeleton without flesh and blood held together by the tendons, reduced to disconnected bones, worse than that, older than that, scattered in all directions, here a bone of the hand, there a bone of the foot, a shin bone, a thigh bone, the pelvis, spine and skull, reduced to bleached bones of conch-like colors, reduced to bones more than a year old lying in a heap, reduced to bones gone rotten and some become dust. And then he applies this perception to his own body thus, by saying, verily, also my body is the same nature, such it will become and will not escape it. Thus he lives contemplating the body in the body. And so, mindfulness of body is a way of being able to look at what is the nature of this body. The body performs actions. The body consists of many different parts. The body is, the formation of the body is elements. This body is transitory in nature. This body arises and destroys. Ultimately, the body itself becomes dust. And therefore, what is the nature of body? Is the body only that what I have supposed it to be? Or are the different aspects of the body understood by the mind? And so, learning about your body, mindfulness of the body, is knowing your body, learning your body. When you learn your body, you appreciate your body better in its fullness. And appreciation of the fullness of the body is the profound and the powerful way of detachment to the body. Sometimes people think, if I learn the many different factors of the body, then somehow that will make me neglect the body. But that's precisely the opposite that happens. Is when you learn about the many facets of the body, the preoccupation with the relationship to the body as an entity so solid and yours alone, independent and non-composite, doesn't happen. And a much more pervasive understanding of the body in its fuller happens. Where that arises, there is greater appreciation, but the appreciation completely is powerful in cutting through attachment to the body. Sense of sort of attachment is very much a linear view. And so where the body in its fullness is understood, suppleness arises in the relationship to the body. And so therefore, working in meditation, reading the section, and after each section, putting the material down, the text down, and really giving it a thought, contemplating, in post-meditation, being mindful of the body, with silence, with stillness, with as much single-pointed awareness as possible relating to mindfulness of body. Likewise, the contemplation on feeling, mindfulness of feeling. How does a monk live contemplating feelings and feeling? Herein, a monk, when experiencing a pleasant feeling, knows, I experience a pleasant feeling. So just as with the body, when one is mindful of the body in action, without, however, a very long discourse or a commentary on the body, likewise, when it comes to the feelings, as we spoke about earlier, trying to let the feeling be a natural expression, or what we call the vivacious sort of expression, natural expression of awareness, without entrapping it into becoming a personal sort of an experience, it is essential to relate to experience of feeling in its most simplest of the form, freeing it from the tendencies of interference and grasping. And the most sort of profound way of relating to it is where a meditator knows, I experience a pleasant feeling. When experiencing a painful feeling, he knows, I experience a painful feeling. There is no added commentary to that. Who is responsible for this pain? Who is responsible for this pleasure? What happens to it? Whom? How can I do it? What can I do with it? Sort of the sort of multiplicity in which it is then sort of broken into, is cut short, is destroyed by keeping it very much based upon simply a recognition of the experience. When experiencing neither a pleasant nor painful feeling, he knows, I experience neither pleasant nor painful feeling. When experiencing a pleasant worldly feeling, he knows, I experience a pleasant worldly feeling. When experiencing a pleasant spiritual feeling, he knows, I experience a pleasant spiritual feeling. That's what our teachers would always say. You experience something, you experience something. There's nothing wrong with that. So some people who then think, I should not experience anything as a meditator, then that's also very wrong. So constantly keeping our teacher's instruction in mind, don't pretend to be dead. A corpse has no feelings. As an alive person, you have feelings. There's nothing wrong with that. Wherever did you read, Buddhists, good Buddhists have no feelings? But the sort of not wanting, the sort of effect of not wanting to grasp or thinking that that is going to then becoming, again, causes that lead to a distracted mind. We often subdue forceful feeling. We suppress feelings, which is the wrong thing to do. You have to make friends with the feelings. So when you meet a nice friend, you shake hands, you hug, you do your normal kisses on the cheeks, then you go on doing your work. In the same way, you don't shake hands, hug, do the kisses, carry your friend on your shoulder, and then walk around. So in the same way, keeping things short, you meet with situations, you meet with feelings, it's a good feeling, good, continue. Don't allow that itself to be stalled into an exaggeration. Do not increase on that. Let it be. So here it says, so all the Vajrayana teachings, letting go, letting be, Mayana teachings, emptiness, nature, examine the nature of emptiness. Very profound methods, but which will be not so necessary if you can keep the commentary short. I experience a present spiritual feeling. Good. That's it. There's nothing more to it. You burst the bubble, and that's fine. And you continue on. Now, that spiritual feeling has a commentary. Then that can run into 1,000 pages. Then you have to post it on Facebook. Let others know. Then you get very worried that nobody is responding to you. How many, what do you call them? Thumbs up. Is there? 5 thumbs up only. So those are the unending commentaries that one brings into. So not doing that. I experience a present spiritual feeling. When experiencing a painful worldly feeling, he knows I experience a painful worldly feeling. That's it. When experiencing a painful spiritual feeling, he knows I experience a painful spiritual feeling. Oh, very good. Keep that in mind. You don't write letters. When experiencing neither pleasant nor painful worldly feelings, he knows I experience neither pleasant nor painful worldly feelings. Then the letter gets worse. Oh, what's wrong with me? Isn't it? Many of you do write letters. I don't have anything to say to you, but I think I have to say something about that. You get worried that neither pleasant nor unpleasant spiritual experiences are coming. So that's just, again, the same sort of habitual tendency that is not satisfied, that urges you to creating an exaggeration, creating, again, an aggravation of many different kinds of causes. Therefore, I experience neither pleasant nor painful worldly feelings, and when experiencing neither pleasant nor painful spiritual feelings, he knows, I experience neither pleasant nor painful spiritual feelings. So what is being said here is, simply whatever arises, it arises, you let it be. Thus he lives contemplating feelings and feeling internally, or he lives contemplating feelings and feeling externally, or he lives contemplating feelings and feeling internally and externally. If the mind seems to be internalized, that's also fine. If the mind seems to be feeling externally, that's also fine. Neither or both, that's also very fine. He lives contemplating originating factors and feelings, or he lives contemplating dissolution factors of feelings, or he lives contemplating origination and dissolution factors and feelings. This feeling came from there, that's also fine. It came from there. This feeling seems to go there, that's also fine. The feeling seems to go there. It came from here and then it went there, that's also very fine. It came from there and it went there. And he lives contemplating. His mindfulness is established with the thought, feelings exist, to the extent necessary just for knowledge and mindfulness. This is crucial. Feelings exist, but it exists as a strong, solid thing. That's not what is being said. Feeling exists only to the extent of the knowledge, only to the extent that it is transitory in nature, it arises, it dissolves, necessary just for knowledge and mindfulness, and he lives detached, without clinging. And therefore it says, lives detached and clings to naught in the world. Thus a monk lives contemplating feelings and feeling. And throughout the session of contemplation, cultivating mindfulness, through the whole session, one feeling or thousands of feeling arises. If one arises, one arises. If a thousand arises, a thousand arises. And therefore there is nothing other than to do but to be mindful that yes, feelings arise. If there is no deliberation to the feelings, then feelings are just the natural nature of your awareness. And beyond that, it isn't anything. Beyond that, there is nothing that it by itself produces. Whatever is further produced of a feeling that arises is just the entrapment that it gets into of the ego that brings about the personal experiences of it. So it's not the previous feeling. It's just a multitude of other feelings that it has imposed upon what originally arose. Therefore, to keep things really short, keep things very, very natural, as close to its nature, simply contemplate feeling as feeling and sort of cut the bridge to the exaggeration and aggravation. Likewise, here in the text, because it is from the translation of a text, the translators have written consciousness, which would then be often referred to as mindfulness of mind. And now, and how, monk, does a monk live contemplating consciousness in consciousness? Or you can simply change that to mind in mind. Herein, monks, a monk knows mind with lust as with lust, mind with without lust as without lust. Now, whether you say consciousness, I'll keep saying consciousness since it is written here. Consciousness with hate as with hate. Consciousness without hate as without hate. consciousness with ignorance as with ignorance, without ignorance as without ignorance, shrunken state of consciousness as a shrunken state of consciousness, distracted state of consciousness as a distracted state of consciousness, developed state of consciousness as a developed state of consciousness, undeveloped state of consciousness as an undeveloped state, state of consciousness with some mental state superior to it as a state with something mentally higher, state of consciousness with no other mental state superior to it as a state with nothing mentally higher, the concentrated state of consciousness as a concentrated state, unconcentrated state of consciousness as unconcentrated state, freed state of consciousness as a freed state, and an unfreed state as an unfreed state. Now what we do is, with lust we try to make it without, without we make it with, shrunken we try to make it big, big we try to shrink. When it is at a certain state, we try to make it elevated and higher. Whatever is in higher state, we become afraid and we shrink it to the very smallest of these states. And so we try to alter it. We never allow the natural nature of one's own being, whatever name we give to it, mind or consciousness. But the fundamental nature is never given the freedom to be. We always bring about an alteration. And therefore, whatever arises is not the mind. What you're trying to train is not the mind. What you're trying to train are all the alterations, and you become busy with the alterations. And therefore, in order to reach truer fundamental state, whatever it is coming up with, whether it is highly elevated, profound, whether it is distracted, whether it is not distracted, just as one would let the clouds not deter the sky itself, in the same way, allowing the gamut of expressions that arises to be whatever it is, but allowing the mindfulness to retain a sense of pervasive awareness of the basis upon which all of the different clouds of creations, such as hatred, lust, ignorance, sort of heightened awareness, or distraction, all of the different kinds of stages arises. And therefore, the Buddha says, thus he lives contemplating consciousness in conscious internally, or he lives contemplating consciousness in consciousness externally. He lives contemplating consciousness in consciousness internally and externally. He lives contemplating origination factors in consciousness, or he lives contemplating dissolution factors in consciousness, or he lives contemplating origination and dissolution factors in consciousness, or his mindfulness is established with the thought consciousness exists only to the extent necessary just for knowledge and mindfulness, and he lives detached, clings to nothing in the world. Thus, a monk lives contemplating consciousness in consciousness, mind in mind. And so, mind, and therefore a pervasive, giving the freedom for whatever is the natural basis, mind or consciousness, to be, upon the surface of which arises many different things. Let it arise. Without your own interference, it arises, just as a cluster of clouds arises and dissolves into the expanse of the space. Likewise, whatever arises, without your own grabbing, deliberation, interference, interpretation, subjecting it to opinions and biases, none of it by themselves have any potential or ability to obscure the natural expanse of one's own mind, of one's own consciousness. Therefore, simply, this is mind, and within the pervasiveness of the mind, there is this feeling, there is this perception, and letting the feeling be, letting the perception be, allowing all that what arises to remain whatever it is, to dissolve however it may be, retaining simply the expansiveness, is one that allows the mindfulness of mind meditation to lead more closely to abiding within the essential empty nature of the mind, essential primordial ground or primordial nature of one's own fundamental mind. Likewise, the contemplation on phenomena. which is called the mindfulness of phenomena meditation. And so the sutra says, and how monks does a monk live? Contemplating mental objects in mental objects. Herein a monk lives, contemplating mental objects in the mental objects of the five hindrances. And how monks does a monk live, contemplating mental objects in the mental objects of the five hindrances? And so the Buddha replied, herein monks, when sense desire is present, a monk knows, this is sense desire in me. When a sense desire is not present, he knows there is no sense desire in me. He knows how the arising of the non-arisen sense desire comes to be. He knows how the abandoning of the arisen sense desire comes to be. And he knows how the non-arising in the future of the abandoned sense desire comes to be. And so, when desire arises in the mind, what are the five hindrances? Are the five poisons. And so when they arise within one's own mind stream, yeah, it arises. This is desire. This is mind not experiencing desire. Whether desire is there, whether desire is not there, clear sense of awareness of how the appearance of desire arises or does not arise. Likewise, when anger is present, he knows there is anger. When anger is not present, he knows there is no anger. If it is left as simple as that, beyond any kind of fabrication or addings, any flavor or additions that one makes to it, that thought simply is anger, and that's the death of it. That's the cessation of it. Where it is not left in its most simple appearance, then the exaggeration and formulation, the grasping immediately sets in, that will aggravate the situation, aggravate the emotion. That is where one feeling has immediately been given the interpretation of a personal experience. And when it is a personal experience, there's a lot of investment made in a personal experience. And so the investment that you put into it will always trigger a pathway of gain and loss, happiness and suffering, hope and fear. Everything comes immediately into it. Therefore, there is no anger in me. He knows how the arising of the non-arisen anger comes to be. If there is no anger, well, then there is no anger. He knows how the abandoning of the anger, arisen anger, comes to be. When you don't interfere with a thought that looks like, seems like anger, and it dissolves, oh yes, that's the dissolution of the anger. Such is the only simple recognition. And he knows how the non-arising in the future of the abandoned anger comes to be. Mind remaining peaceful is simply recognized as having not interfered with the anger. Therefore, there is no recurring power of the aspects of the anger coming back again, is simply known. Likewise, when sloth and torpor are present, or ignorance, he knows. And so in this, simply he knows is written, but when you read it to yourself, you must put in the full form. You have to read the full form of not taking the shortcut, but you have to say, when sloth and torpor are present, he knows how the arising of the non-arisen sloth and torpor comes to be. He knows how the abandoning of the arisen sloth and torpor comes to be, and he knows how the non-arising in the future of this sloth and torpor comes to be. So you have to read the whole section here. When agitation and worry are present, he knows, and then you add the whole paragraph to it. When doubt is present, he knows, and likewise. And each of them, you begin to really read slowly to yourself, understanding and allowing the mindfulness to be supported by the recitation of the sutra, of the text. Thus he lives, contemplating mental objects in mental objects internally. Or he lives contemplating mental objects in mental objects externally. Or he lives contemplating mental objects in mental objects internally and externally. He lives contemplating origination factors in mental objects. Or he lives contemplating dissolution factors in mental objects. Or he lives contemplating origination and dissolution factors in mental objects. His mindfulness is established with the thought, mental objects exist, only to the extent necessary just for knowledge and mindfulness. Thus he lives detached, clinging nothing to the world. Thus also a monk lives contemplating mental objects in the mental objects of the five hindrances. Further, a monk lives contemplating mental objects in the mental objects of the five aggregates. Likewise, as with the five emotions or the five root poisons. Likewise, in terms of being mindful of the phenomena, you take into consideration the very basis of the phenomena, which are the five aggregates. A monk lives contemplating mental objects in the mental object of the five aggregates of clinging. Herein, a monk thinks this is form. This is the form arising of form, and thus is the disappearance of form. Thus is feeling. Thus is the arising of feeling, and thus is the disappearance of feeling. Thus is perception. Thus is the arising of perception. Thus is the disappearance of perception. Thus are formations. Thus is the arising of formations. Thus is the disappearance of formation. Thus is consciousness. Thus is the arising of consciousness. And thus is the disappearance of consciousness. And in this way, he lives contemplating mental objects in mental objects to the extent necessary just for knowledge and mindfulness. And he lives detached and clings not to the world. Thus also a monk lives contemplating five aggregates as the five aggregates. And so this paragraph must be added over here. The conclusion. In the same way, further, a monk lives contemplating mental objects in the mental objects of the six internal and six external sense bases. Now, in order for one to truly bring about cessation, now we're talking about realization of Buddhahood. Realization of Buddhahood dependent upon Dhamma. Dhamma dependent upon wisdom. Wisdom that knows things as they truly are. Now you are reversing habitual patterns of formulation of dualistic concepts. So you have to break them. So in order to break them, you have to actually point sort of to what you have consolidated as solid entity. And breaking down. So the breakdown has to be thoroughly done, and I think it's the most powerful way of doing it, where you take everything. If it makes you tired, that's how you've consolidated it. So you have to break it down. It's almost like taking a hammer and smashing those things that we have not checked, we have not really done. So hard as it might be, just look at the number of words, isn't it? The beauty of the sutra is that it exactly says and articulates what we so quickly assume. So between articulation and assumption, what's more convenient? Assumption is always more convenient. So we often say, yes, aggregates are empty in nature. That's an assumption. Let's see how they are empty in nature. And so the Buddha doesn't waste, is not lazy. So instead of sort of just assuming, he says, no. Herein, a monk knows the eye and visual form and the fetters that arises dependent on both the eyes and the form. He knows how the arising from the non-arisen fetters come to be. He knows how the abandoning of the arisen fetters come to be. And he knows how the non-arising in the futures of the abandoned fetters come to be. And so all the six internal and external sense bases, eyes, the form it sees, ears, the sound it hears, taste, smell, texture, everything, how each one of them arise. And therefore, when you look at them even more finely, you begin to say, when the eyes see something, you tell yourself mindfully, eyes see a form, and that's it. When you hear a sound mindfully, the ear consciousness hears the sound, recognized by the sense consciousness of the ears. When you feel a certain temperature, mindfully you know your senses externally become aware of the temperature, which internally is felt by the body consciousness. And so therefore, here being mindful requires you to be mindful of all the very fine, subtler ways of how the six internal and the six external sense bases begin to function. He knows the ear and sounds. He knows the nose and smell. He knows the tongue and flavors, the body and the tactile objects, textual objects, the mind and the mental objects, and the fetters that arise dependent on both. He knows how the arising of non-arisen fetters come to be. He knows how the abandoning of the arisen fetters come to be. He knows how the non-arising in the future of the abandoned fetters come to be. So what he knows over here is whatever is external, known, recognized, comes to be. He knows when they are grasped internal. He knows they are internally grasped. Thoughts that arises, he recognizes that as the product of the consciousness, senses, sense objects, and the sense consciousness. When there is nothing that the mind at this moment is recognizing, he knows it is a moment where it is not recognizing anything. So the sense of alertness, sense of vigilance of how one is relating to the phenomenal display. Thus, monks, the monk lives contemplating mental objects in mental objects. And further, monks, a monk lives contemplating mental objects in the mental objects of the seven factors of enlightenment, whether it is mindfulness, discernment, diligence, joy, pliancy, concentration, samadhi, or equanimity, all of these seven factors of enlightenment. Monks, when the enlightenment factors of mindfulness is present, the monk knows the enlightenment factor of mindfulness is in me. For example, if joy arises, one of the enlightenment factors, he knows joy, and therefore that is it. If there is tranquility or pliancy, yes, it arises. If there is mindfulness, he knows it is mindfulness. If there is discernment, the second, there is discernment. If there is diligence, he knows there is diligence. Joy, he knows there is joy, the fourth. Suppleness is the fifth, seven factors of enlightenment. When pliancy or suppleness arises, he knows pliancy and suppleness arises. When there is one-pointed concentration, he knows there is concentration. When there is equanimity, the seventh, he knows there is equanimity. And in the absence of it, when there is no equanimity, he knows there is no equanimity. When there is no samadhi or concentration, he knows there is none. And therefore, here it means, when the enlightenment factors of mindfulness is present, the monk knows the enlightenment factors of mindfulness is in me. When the enlightenment factors of mindfulness is absent, he knows the enlightenment factors of mindfulness is not in me. And he knows how the arising of these arises. He knows how the perfection in the development of the arisen enlightenment factors of mindfulness come to be. When the enlightenment factors of the investigation of mental object is present, the monk knows the enlightenment factors of the investigation of mental objects is in me. When the enlightenment factors of the investigation of mental objects is absent, he knows the enlightenment factors of the investigation of mental objects is not in me. When you are sitting in shamatha, what it means here is that you are sitting in shamatha. When you are analyzing and doing vipassana, you know you are doing vipassana. The vipassana leads to being able to recognize something. You recognize something. It doesn't lead you to recognizing anything. It doesn't let you to recognizing anything. Behind not realizing, now this is again something important to keep in mind, is mindfulness more important or is the result more important? If the mindfulness of your vipassana is there, that's more important. Result and the search for result could be another trap of the mind that loses mindfulness in chasing after a result, which is personal experience. So meditative experience, we talk about that, which is good. But every teacher will tell you, never grasp meditation experience, meditative experiences. Why it is so is because in pursuit of a result, you lose the mindfulness. Where the mindfulness is lost, rather than the awareness, you've again sunk into personal experience as being more important. Therefore, here, that's what is being stressed at the moment. So when the enlightenment factor of investigation of mental object is present, the monk knows. Enlightenment factor of investigation of mental object is in me. Enlightenment factor of the investigation of mental object absent. He knows the enlightenment factor of the investigation of mental object is not in me. He knows how the arising of non-arisen enlightenment factors of investigation of mental objects come to be, and how perfection in the development of the arisen enlightenment factors of investigation of mental objects come to be. And likewise, adding the same paragraph, when enlightenment factors of energy is present, he knows. And then you insert the whole paragraph. When the enlightenment factors of joy is present, when enlightenment factor of tranquility is present, when enlightenment factor of concentration is present, enlightenment factor of equanimity is present, these then being the seven branches of enlightenment, he lives contemplating mental objects in mental objects. And further, a monk lives contemplating mental objects in the mental objects of the Four Noble Truths. Does a monk live contemplating mental objects in the mental objects of the Four Noble Truths? Herein, a monk knows this is suffering. According to the reality, he knows this is the origin of suffering. According to the reality, he knows this is the cessation of suffering. According to reality, he knows this is the road leading to the cessation of suffering according to reality. Particularly, this then in post-meditation. When you see situations, and you are able to, beyond an argument, if you are able to see, oh, this is the origin of suffering. This is suffering. Patience, oh, this is cessation. This is the path. Patience is the path that brings about the cessation of suffering. Being able to take in the view of the Dhamma, view of the truer nature of things as they are, rather than the apparentness. Therefore, in the life of some of all of our great teachers, of all our great masters, this is what you will find, is the pervasive view of the causes that are happening, of that are being created, rather than the person or the immediate resultant state of it. So that when there is some of the most unfortunate circumstances, sympathy is much more the prominent expression rather than becoming insulted by that adversity. So one of the things that we find in our teachers, for example, when even very sort of in all its appearances, when very unfortunate, many, many different kinds of painful things are being done to you, such as, you know, the situation of many of our teachers when they talk about their imprisonment. One of the significant things that we find that is common in all of their expressions is how sorry they were for those who inflicted the pain. So there's immediately a sense of being able to have empathy and compassion to, because it's not so much what is being done to them, but much more their ability to locate and see all the causes that go into the creation of that kind of an painful experience. So suffering is seen, cause of suffering is seen more acutely, mindfully. Therefore, sympathy and understanding is much more there. When we are unable to see this in our daily life, then we see who is doing it, to whom, and what I have been influenced, or how much of that has influenced me. So it becomes, again, your personal experience. So because it becomes your personal experience, you reply or respond to that by another aggravation. So the impatience comes in more strongly than the patience or the sympathetic attitude. Therefore, in order to be able to really emulate the bodhisattva's conduct, suffering, sort of cause of suffering, origin of suffering, cessation, as well as the path to cessation, is mindfully seen by a meditator. Thus, he lives contemplating mental objects in mental objects. Verily, monks, whosoever practices these four foundations of mindfulness in this manner, then one of these two fruits may be expected by him: highest knowledge or wisdom here and now, or if some remainder of clinging is yet present, the state of non-returning. And so The fourth foundation of mindfulness itself leads to the path of seeing, or path of being able to truly recognize the absolute nature as is, resulting into the attainment of what is called the state of non-returning, or arahatship, which is again not sort of dissimilar from path of no more learning, what the Mahayana often refer to as the sort of the accomplishment of the fifth path. Because of this, it was said, this is the only way, monks, for the purification of beings. Now, what purification? Purification of constant, purification from the constant sort of enslavement of the habitual patterns. So one is able to purify habitual patterns for the overcoming of sorrow and lamentation, suffering of samsara, consequences of causes or karma, for the destruction of suffering and grief, which is cessation, for reaching the right path, for the attainment of nirvana, namely the four foundations of mindfulness. Thus spoke the Blessed One, satisfied the monks approved of his words. So I hope that is also then approved by you. So this is then one of the very fundamental sutras, unfortunately, which was not translated into Sanskrit and therefore not really put into so many words in Tibetan, because most of the Tibetan texts were translated from Sanskrit. And so, however, the very basis, the foundation of the wealth, the treasury of knowledge of Buddhist tradition comes from the Pali tradition also. Therefore, the Pali version survived, and therefore there's this very much in the language, at least the pronunciation of many of the words is the Pali language. And so one of the, however, the basis of meditation of Buddhist tradition called the mindfulness meditation is in this way. Now, why I read this whole thing to you is to encourage you to incorporate that into your meditation so that one doesn't do these abstract meditations of mindfulness. I'm always very suspicious when people say, I do mindfulness meditation. Because if the mindfulness meditation is all about emotional experiences, you're mindfully aware of your emotions, then that is like drinking salted water to quench your thirst. There's no end to it. One day you will feel good, one day you will feel bad. On a good day you'll feel inspired, on a bad day you'll feel discouraged. And that does not have the power of taming, transforming lifetimes and lifetimes of habitual patterns. Mindfulness is only related to these four pivotal things upon the basis of which, correctly understood, Buddhahood is understood. Incorrectly understood, you trust the ego more. And therefore, that is body, feelings, mind, and phenomena. Ultimately, all confusion arises because body is not understood, feeling is not understood, mind is not understood, phenomena is not understood. Dhamma is recognizing what the body is, knowing what feelings truly are, truly understanding what mind is, and recognizing reality of phenomena as it truly is. When you know things as they truly are, that is then called prajnaparamita, knowing wisdom. When wisdom arises, cessation is then possible. Then you can continue with your big project of liberating all sentient beings.